This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
For a social scientist, you represent a voice that we don't hear from often, that is your subjects. I'm also excited to hear that hundreds of thousands of people may watch this. My undergrads describe my lectures as a cure for insomnia. So I'd like it makes me feel good to know that all those people are going to sleep better at night because of my work. So it's a little bit odd over the last 5 years that I've found myself in this position talking about ethics, because I'm not an ethicist and I'm not an experimentalist. I'm just a person who works on Latin America. I do research on democracies and elections and things like that. But I'm one of many people who started asking questions about the direction that political science and social sciences more broadly have gone. And it's really exciting to me to have an opportunity to dialogue with you and hear what you think about some of the issues I'm going to present. So I'll go through a couple of the key issues, and hopefully we can have a great discussion. Now, when I talk about ethics, when I tell my colleagues I'm working on ethics, you can see the first line I get. The first line I get is, you've got to be kidding me. And they say that because historically political science and most social science is a purely observational field. We just observe what happened in the world. We collect data on what happened, on election outcomes, and so we don't intervene in the world. And so to the extent that we have done that experiments, and we've done them for 50 plus years, they've been undergraduates in laboratories on campus who want a little extra beer money or pizza money or whatever. They watch a video, they answer a survey, they play a little game, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so things have been really safe. And indeed, this is a little bit of data from... So let me just note, when I file an IRB, that is an ethical review for something, the thing I have to warn subjects about is that they might become bored. That's the big risk. Historically, things have changed, as you'll see in a moment. But first, a little more data. This is from Charlie Plott, an economist at Caltech. He was an early experimentalist doing all those lab experiments on campus. He talked to other people like himself. And over the course of their careers, they estimated that they had seen over 100,000 subjects, and that over those 100,000 and some subjects, there had been zero reports of harm and one adverse incident. That adverse incident was an undergrad who became angry because in an economic game, he went bankrupt and he lost. And so that's historically, that's why people say, you've got to be kidding me. But things have changed. Things have changed quite a bit. So I collected some data from journals, political science journals, where our research is published, just from six of our top journals. And I coded the number of pages and the number of, articles dedicated to experiments. So the first graph in the upper left-hand corner shows over time the percentage of publications that are focused on experiments. You can see that we've been doing experiments infrequently, but we've been doing them for a long time. But starting around, say, 2000, 2005, things really take off. Now, in our top journals, by 2010, we were at over 30%. Today, some journals are well over 50%. In other words, over half of our published research, our top published research, is experimental today. So we're doing a lot more experiments, number one. Number two, we're not just doing them on campus anymore. So just in those six journals, the map shows where we had done experiments by the 1980s and where by 2010, 11, 12. And you can see we've spread to South America. We're doing experiments in Africa. We're doing experiments in Asia, all over Europe. Indeed, this only represents published work in just six of our journals. There's conference papers, there's working papers, there's dissertations, there's other journals. There are journals in those countries. There are Brazilian political science journals, Chilean political science journals. I would bet that almost every country on the planet has had a political science experiment at this point. And then lastly, we're not just playing games in empty classrooms anymore. So you can see that we still, if you look at the rate of experiment types by decade, we're doing more lab experiments, but two things have changed. One is the number of survey experiments have exploded. That's mostly because of the internet. We can deploy a survey now very inexpensively. We don't have to send people door to door, et cetera. But second, we're doing something called field experiments, which I'm going to talk about quite a bit tonight. So let me give you a couple of examples of things that prompted me to start asking questions. So some ambitious graduate students, great motivation. They want to study bribery and corruption in Mexico. So they pay actors to randomly assign them to be middle class or lower class, so they change their clothes in their car, and they pay them to make illegal left-hand turns in front of police officers in Mexico City. And they learned some interesting things, like nobody got a ticket, right? Everybody was able to get out of their tickets. And they learned that higher status individuals were asked less frequently, but when they were asked for more. It's kind of an interesting, it's a really interesting finding. And I know for a fact that those graduate students are very dedicated to the fight against corruption. But there's some things that might not seem quite right about this. Let's just think about them for a moment. We have uninformed and unconsenting subjects. So the police officers are the subjects here. Nobody asked them if they wanted to be in a research study. We also have potential harm to bystanders, right? So you're making illegal traffic moves in Mexico City. Other people are driving cars. There was no approval by Mexican authorities for this. It was approved by Yale's IRB, but nobody in Mexico had even heard about this. Technically, the intervention itself was illegal, and it attempted to induce additional illegal activity. With two small caveats, a few years ago I gave a talk in Mexico City, and at 2 a.m. after the talk, I was in a car, and a Mexican professor was driving it, and we were going the wrong way around a huge traffic circle at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was completely nonchalant about it, and I was terrified out of my mind. So maybe traffic laws, maybe it's not that serious, but even so, it just doesn't quite sound right that the principal investigators used U.S. money to commit crimes in a foreign country to get a publication, right? That doesn't seem quite right to me. So these are the kinds of questions I've been asking. Here's another example. Again, a well-motivated study with an important question about democracy. So in a number of authoritarian and democracies, political scientists have focused on transparency, on shedding light on the behavior of legislators. It's been done in Malawi and Vietnam, a few other places. And so what do? They get data on how many bills a legislator wrote, did they go to committee meetings, how many speeches did they make, and they publicize it. And they randomly do it for half the legislators. They don't reveal that information for the other half of the legislators. And then they observe what kinds of behavior result from that. It's had some significant changes in behavior. So legislators in Malawi started going to committee meetings. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's not. Maybe they should be out doing constituency service. Legislators in Vietnam, the ones who were selected into the group to be to receive quote-unquote sunshine is what they call the treatment, they all lost their jobs. The Communist Party basically ended their careers and told them, you will not run again, your career's over, have a nice day. Maybe they'll get another chance someday. So a few thoughts about that. In U.S. regulation, public officials don't actually have IRB protection. But And technically, they worked with an NGO, a nonprofit organization, to do this. But are they still responsible in these situations? It's also worth asking, should a legislator in an authoritarian country count as a public official? They may be a party hack. They may have been told, you will now be a legislator. I don't know exactly how that works in Vietnam. And certainly millions of constituents would have been affected by legislators' reallocation of time. I don't know what the Malawi legislators were doing before they started going to committee meetings. Maybe they were doing something good, maybe they weren't. But there are questions to ask. Here's one from this country called the United States of America that actually got a lot of headlines a couple of years ago. So, again, a great motivation. How do we increase turnout? And they studied the a state Supreme Court election. This one generated a lot of controversy. Charges were filed against Stanford and Dartmouth. Presidents had to apologize and reach out to over 100,000 Montanans. Let's take a closer look at this. So in Montana, they elect their state Supreme Court members. These are two of the candidates that were running against each other. Mike Wheat, the incumbent, Lawrence Van Dyke, his challenger. They sent out an information flyer, typical field experiment. They sent out information about them to some Montanans, not to others. The idea is they're going to observe if turnout is different for people received and people who did not. Let's look at the flyer. So this is the flyer they sent. And first, let's just understand what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do is see if knowing more about the election makes it more likely that people will vote. Political scientists care a great deal about turnout. We want people to participate in democracy. So they say, well, if people understand what's at stake, well, then they'll be more likely to vote. So let's give them some information. And the information they gave them was they placed the candidates in each of the two races on an ideological scale, from left to right, close to Barack Obama, or at that time the Republican candidate for president, Mitt Romney. So you can see the two candidates there, Mike Wheat, by their measure, was close to Mr. Obama, and Mr. Van Dyke close to Mr. Romney. Okay, so what are some of the potential issues with this? So they actually didn't get in trouble for the research ethics. They got in trouble for using the steel of the great state of Montana without permission. And so the flyer looks like an official document, right? So that's what they actually had litigation about. But there are still a number of ethical issues. Notice that they also got in trouble because, unlike most of these studies, they put their name on there, right? So in some ways, this was more honest than the hundreds of other similar studies because they actually said this is part of a research study. So they got in trouble for doing things better than the typical study like this because most of these don't have any return address. Okay, two other things. Notice that this is supposed to be a nonpartisan election. And so they sent out 100,000 of these in the state of Montana. Population of Montana isn't that high. And they've injected a significant amount of partisanship into what's supposed to be a nonpartisan election. And then lastly, these measures of ideology, where do they come from? I do a lot of work on statistics for political science as well. They're not from a survey. They're not from bills they wrote or anything like that. They use a statistical method to estimate their ideology based on their campaign donations. So it's not a perfect or really precise measure. For Mr. Herbert, he had two donors, right? One of them was himself, right? And he gave himself, I think, about $5,000. Someone gave him $100. And so based on that, they placed him as an extreme conservative in this case. And so maybe they're not providing really precise, truthful, accurate information. Maybe at a minimum, for those of you that are statisticians, maybe there should be confidence intervals at a minimum or some other information. So political science has embraced experiments, and it's been really good for us. But we are seeing a lot of new problems. And I've written about a lot of these problems. I'm only going to focus on two, but I'll just briefly mention we're doing experiments in new contextual environments. So people have had problems with personal security, trying to do studies in Ukraine, in Crimea, and other places. I know some experimentalists were literally going to be torched in Guatemala. Sort of they were just doing the wrong thing in the wrong way in the wrong environment. And so that's one set of issues. I'm not going to talk about those so much tonight. The second is international regulatory issues. I've mentioned that the study in Mexico didn't have permission from Mexico. I'll talk about some of the issues related to that in just a moment. The third is this idea of field experiments. And so field experiments are, the three examples I just gave you are field experiments. Well, we're not in a lab, we're in the real world, and people don't know we're there. And we're intervening in some way, and that raises quite a few issues for my field. Lastly, this question of agency. So political scientists are frequently partnering with NGOs and governments to do studies. And essentially, if the NGO, if they can convince an NGO or the government to do the randomized controlled trial to do the intervention, then they can just get the data and it's sort of, they're absolved from all sin. And that agency question seems to be manipulated. Now today, for time constraints, I'm just going to focus on these two. So we'll talk briefly about international regulations, some of the issues I've seen. Then we'll talk about what are the big issues in field experiments. And I'd like to hear what you think. So international regulations. Historically, political scientists, most social scientists, don't get asked by their IRBs if they've done any IRB approval in other countries. So as a grad student, no one ever asked me, well, did you get approval from the Brazilian authorities? What you're doing there? And it had never crossed anyone's mind. It certainly hadn't crossed my mind. However, it turns out that most countries actually have rules and regulations governing the conduct of research, especially research by foreigners, because they've had all sorts of nasty things done by U.S. anthropologists and U.S. pharmaceuticals and all sorts of things. So there are rules. And so most scholars today, I won't say most, I'll say many, continue to ignore those laws. They fly in on a tourist visa, just do the experiment and head home with data. Basically, I call it a black ops experiment. As they go under the radar, do the project and get out. There's an argument that that's a good thing, which I'll give you in a minute. There's an argument that it's a bad thing as well. But one implication for us is that a lot of research funded by you, taxpayers, that's conducted overseas is actually illegally conducted. So let's just consider a couple examples. So China has fairly clear regulations about how to do research there, how to do a survey, who do you have to partner with. I've done a survey in China. I had to partner with Peking University. They're approved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But one way to think about it is that only research that's pro-regime or at least not threatening to the regime is going to be allowed. Is pro-democracy research going to be allowed? Is anything threatening to the regime going to be allowed? No. And so a lot of questions that political scientists ask are threatening to bad people. And so if you always play by the rules of the game, you might not be able to do ethical research. That's a position that people who work on China have taken. All right, the case that I work on most is Brazil. They have a clear national administrative law that governs how scholars are supposed to obtain research, and they pay special attention to foreign scholars. I went through that process. It was unbelievably painful. It took over a year for me to do this. They didn't even answer my email. They didn't answer the phone. I invited them to a conference in La Jolla, and I would pay their effort. They didn't answer that either. I don't know what. I don't know why, but I couldn't get them to respond to any of my inquiries. So I was called stupid for even trying to do this because in the interim, someone else published a similar paper to the one that I was trying to do. My grad student was a co-author. There were costs to him. I'll talk about the trade-offs for this in a moment. Third case, Malawi. Also clear and straightforward procedures, which include paying their staff 10% of your budget, right? So some people would say, is that a bribe? Do you have to pay a bribe to do research here? Is that what's happening? Okay, so what are some of the issues to think about? Do we have an obligation to comply with host nations' laws? And the three questions we can extract are, from the Brazilian case, what if the process is slow and bureaucratic and useless? And my argument has been that we should engage their IRBs and try to work something out. And I'm happy to report that things have gotten a lot better in Brazil. And you can actually get through an IRB there now. I don't have answers, because I don't have to have answers, thankfully, for the China case or the case of Malawi. sort of a, if there's a corrupt IRB, what should we do? If there's an authoritarian country and you're doing a study on democratization or protest movements, is that research we shouldn't do? Or if we're going to do it, do we need to do it illegally? Or is there a third way where you do a survey, but your computer's out of the country and they go through the internet and maybe that doesn't count? These are difficult questions that scholars who work on these countries have to grapple with. I don't have all the answers. So let's talk about field experiments and some of the issues associated with them. First of all, what's a field experiment? The term actually came from agricultural studies where you had fields and crops and so on. In social science, it means we intervene in the real world, we're randomizing something, and then we're going to observe behavior. And usually, not always, but usually, the subjects don't know that they're being studied. And they don't know why they got a flyer or why they got a construction project or why they got any of these things. They just got one, and we observe their behavior. And so a couple of typical political science examples would include things like you send a campaign flyer to some people, you send nothing to other people. You see who voted. Whether or not you voted is public record. How you voted isn't. So how would we study how you voted? We'd send a flyer to everybody in your precinct and to nobody in your precinct, and we could compare precinct behavior. And if we did that over a lot of precincts, we could estimate the effect of a flyer on your voting behavior or on average voting behavior. Another study might be we might pretend to be a constituent, maybe your legislators, and we'd pretend to be constituents, or our research assistants would, and they'd send emails or make phone calls, and they might randomly vary race or gender through a number of signaling mechanisms to see, do legislators respond differently to people of different race or ethnicity? Are they more responsive to one ethnicity than another? I would call those important questions, but they raise quite a few issues. And let's just note again that I'm gonna come back to this in a minute. Subjects often don't know that they're subjects. They do this to professors, by the way. People will send you an email and say, hi, I'm a prospective student. Can you do X, Y, and Z for me? And then a couple weeks later, you might get an email saying, remember that email? It was fake. We're studying you. Professors are usually offended when that happens, but they're not offended when they're doing it, which is kind of interesting. All right, so let's just think for a minute about one of these field experiments where I'm going to send a flyer to some of you and not others. And maybe it's a reminder to vote, maybe it's some other information, maybe it's a negative ad flyer, whatever. And then I'm going to see whether or not you vote. That's what the Montana people are doing, right? Some Montanans were going to get that flyer, some Montanans weren't. They'd see who voted. The people that do these defend them vigorously. And they would say, what's the harm to you? You're going to get a paper cut, right? You get flyers in the mail every day. How are you harmed? During an election, I get so much campaign mail. It's unbelievable. What is one extra flyer going to do to you? Nothing. No harm here. They'd also point out that this isn't going to change an election result. If it was that easy, if one little flyer would change an election result, come on, even the Russians would be doing it, right? So maybe they are. All right. The thing we're doing, the treatment we're administering, the flyer, it's something you see all the time. It's something in your daily life. It's not some sort of dangerous drug or anything like that. And then they'd say, there's actually benefit to this. We're giving voters information. We're going to give them factual information. Isn't that always a good thing? More information for voters? And they learn a lot. And we have learned a lot about what gets people to vote and how they respond to negative ads versus positive ads and so on. We've learned a lot through these. But there's another side to this story which would say the following. First, maybe the probability of changing an election outcome isn't as small as you think, especially when in the presidential election, might be kind of tough to do it with your little budget and your one flyer. In that Montana study, depending on which newspaper article you read, the researchers had between $100,000 and $350,000. So it's very likely, it's certainly very possible, that they outspent all the candidates combined. So they were the biggest campaigners in the study. Mr. Herbert had $6,000, right? So they way out-campaigned Mr. Herbert. They were the biggest campaigner in the election. So the chances of affecting the election might actually be quite quite large and significant. Second, changing an election, when we do things, democracy has a natural aggregating effect. So you change enough votes, you're not just affecting your subjects, you're affecting all these bystanders as well. Right? You're affecting an entire political system. Now, I talked to a number of Democratic activists and party activists about this, and they hated the Montana study, and they said that even if they didn't change the election result, there could be harmful consequences, because any change in vote share can hurt a candidate, because it might make it harder for them to get nominated next time, harder for them to raise money next time. And they said they've also changed the nature of the election by delivering that ideological message. They might not even want to run. It might be hard for me to recruit a good candidate, some of the positions. And maybe some of these little flyers that come in the mail, maybe they could stress you out. Let me give you an example. So 20,000 people in Michigan, this is the favorite experiment of the last couple of years. It's called the social pressure experiment. 20,000 people in Michigan got these. This was, the first time it was used. And it's a message that says, just so you know, we're watching you and your neighbors. And after the election, we're going to tell everybody if you voted. Now, that's public information. You could look up my voting record back to my first election that I was eligible to vote in. It's public information. But it isn't public information that we wear on our sleeve. And so maybe people deserve a little bit of privacy in this situation. It's worth noting that in the publication reporting this, they say, oh, people didn't seem to like it. A lot of them called and said they wanted to be taken off the mailing list. It turns out this is pretty effective at increasing turnout, usually. There are a couple cases where it's reduced turnout. It's getting used all over. So this is from the LA Times 2 years ago. I don't know who did the study. It might have actually been a campaign doing the study, not a political scientist. Campaigns have adopted this technology because they've learned that it works, that they can get people to vote this way. So somebody did this in a neighborhood in Los Angeles, and they wrote about it. Offended, harassed, violated. That actually sounds like more than a paper cut to me. That sounds like emotional harm. It sounds like psychological harm. Something that maybe we shouldn't administer to people without their permission. Maybe we shouldn't put people in studies without their permission and do this to them. A couple of quotes from that article. Someone decided she's not going to vote. Someone else called it vulgar and invasive and was offended because, as I mentioned previously, most of these kinds of studies, there's no return address. They don't tell you who they are. They just send the flyer. Okay. Let's briefly consider a different kind of field experiment, and then I'll wrap up. A second type is called a correspondence study. So we interact with our subjects, but we lie about who we are and what we want. So we send fake resumes out to see if there's discrimination in who you hire. We make client inquiries to businesses. We contact politicians to see if they'll call us back. And these are all of these studies, nearly all of them, I would have good motivations. Is there discrimination in representation? Is there discrimination in hiring? Those are good questions. And it's a really good design. It's a really good research approach when people are doing something bad that they want to hide. If legislators are racist and they won't respond to certain kinds of people, this is a good design for detecting that. And you might say, well, what's the cost? Just a few minutes of their time, they'll never miss it. They get calls all the time. Yes, but I've seen a couple of studies where someone wanted to contact 10,000 legislators over many countries. And my line was, well, you estimated 12 minutes on each task, so that actually turns into about a year of public time that you're leveraging for free without permission for your study. And so why don't we ever consider that total cost? Why do we only consider the individual cost of what we're doing? I've made the case and been laughed at that this might actually be a form of fraud or even generate some sort of lawsuit, but it did. So in Colombia, a business professor tried one of these studies on restaurants. They figured it out. They sued him. Colombia had to settle. He did okay. He's at Stanford now. So anyway. So what are the big issues here that we can talk about? One is, should we look at individual harm or aggregate harm? Should we look at the risk of a paper cut or the risk of changing an election? IRBs just look at the individual harm. They don't think about those bigger questions. Are the things we're doing to people potentially valuable? Are they really valuable to them? Are we giving them information that's going to make democracy stronger? Or are the things we're doing kind of ambiguous? If I send you information, negative information about a candidate, and I push you to the left or the right, can I call either of those a good thing and still call myself a political scientist? How powerful are the subjects? If we're deceiving people and we don't have consent, does it matter if they're legislators performing public duties versus private citizens going about their lives? Now, I've made the argument several times in writing and with other scholars that the most important issue is actually this question of informed consent. If we had informed consent from our subjects, those issues wouldn't matter. These issues come up because we're effectively forcing people into a study. We're making them participate. They don't have a choice. We're deciding, we're sending them the treatment. We could argue all day, and philosophers have argued for a long time, about when can we treat people without their consent. So rather than argue about it, because I'm not a philosopher, and I've never accused of being all that smart, I thought maybe we could just ask our subjects. So that's what I did. I did a survey. I'm just going to show you one or two things, but I did a survey of subjects, my logic being, if the subjects, if they knew about all these studies, if they didn't like them, and they didn't want to be in them, we should take that into consideration. And in fact, usually when they detect these kind of under-the-radar field experiments, they frequently don't like them. So I contacted 3,000 residents of the U.S. I described some hypothetical experiments where someone's sending you a flyer and then they're going to observe your behavior. And I varied a couple things about it. I varied, did they send you a flyer that was a negative ad? Or did they send you a flyer that was a reminder to floss? Or did they send you a reminder to vote, something like that? So let's just look at how different the results are. This is from left to right, the percentage that agree it's acceptable to conduct this study. On the far right is strongly agree it's okay to do this. On the far left, strongly disagree that it's okay to do this. And the question here was, is it okay to, with people's consent, to send a flyer reminding them to floss? Not surprisingly, most people said it's acceptable with permission to send a flyer reminding people to floss. This is what it looks like if you say there's no consent, the researcher's doing this under the radar, and they're sending you a negative ad. It's factually accurate negative ad, but it's a negative ad. It's a reminder that a candidate got a DUI 5 years ago. And some people don't mind, but the modal response now is strongly disagree, and many people don't think it's acceptable for researchers to do this kind of behavior. A follow-up question to that was, suppose you learned that a study like this had been conducted in your community and you were one of the subjects, how would you feel? Would you be glad you were in the study? Would you rather not have been in the study, or you wouldn't care either way? And so for three different types of study without consent, the flossing reminder, turnout reminder, and DUI reminder, you'll see that 30% of people didn't want to be reminded. They didn't want to be in a study where we were just reminding them to floss. Right? I don't like dentists either, but I actually thought that was a little bit high. On the turnout reminder, about 25% of my respondents said, I don't want to be in a study like that. And on this flyer that's a reminder, so-and-so got a DUI 5 years ago, don't vote for them, almost half of them don't want to be in that. Now, half is pretty high, but honestly, even 20-25%, if 20-25% of our subjects don't want to be in our studies and we're effectively forcing them into our studies, I don't know if that's what we should be doing. So I don't have all the answers, but I don't like the evidence so far. So I'm going to wrap up with a couple of bigger observations before we have a discussion. Social scientists who are doing this kind of work, they care deeply about turnout. They care deeply about fighting corruption. They care deeply about discrimination. And so they're not, I don't believe any of them are evil people in any sense. They want to solve problems. They want to make the world a better place. But the world we're in, oops, I think I went too far there, but the world we're in creates conditions for some trouble. One is, we are curious and ambitious people, and we want answers. That's what scientists do, is we seek answers. We're in environments where we have a great deal of potential power, especially when we're doing this in other countries. Because a sort of foreign researcher with a budget in U.S. dollars is just able to do a lot more in these environments. And people often let scholars do a lot more. Ethical research will frequently get in the way of our best interests. It'll make our research more expensive. It'll make it harder to do. It'll slow us down. And it might even make the research not as good science. So we can actually do better science if we ignore the ethical issues. So maybe it's not surprising that most of the studies I presented, there were graduate students or junior faculty involved, because they're the ones that are stressed out about trying to get tenure and advance their careers or get a job. And so maybe it's not surprising. So experimentalists have been hoping for years that I would just go away. I've been talking about this for about 6 years now. But instead, what's happened is more and more people are starting to ask these questions, which I think is healthy for political science. At this point, the American Political Science Association has an ethics guide with just 30 words about human subjects. You should take into account possible risk, and maybe you have to assess other things. I've been part of a committee that has completely rewritten this part of the ethics guide with a set of principles for responsible and appropriate research. It's being considered by the American Political Science Association this spring and summer. Hopefully there will be some action on it at our annual meeting in September. So, solutions will take time. And I'm actually really excited to hear what you think about some of these questions and these research projects, because you're the subjects. And I would bet that some of you have been research subjects in these projects. So thank you for listening to all this, and I'm really excited about our discussion.
All right, so I found that talk fascinating because you covered so many things, and the kinds of ethics questions that interest me are not the black and white questions, but the ones that are really hard to sort out. And so I'm going to start by throwing a really hard question to you that's fundamental to a lot of what you talked about. You mentioned IRBs often, and I don't know if everybody caught that and if everybody knows that, but IRB stands for Institutional Review Board. The idea is that this is a group of people in your institution who hopefully have some expertise in thinking about whether a study should be done or should not be done. And that approval is necessary in certain areas, but historically it was, or it has been, maybe it still is, ignored by some political scientists for some of these things. So I don't want to put you on the spot so much that I'll ask you what your experience is, but can you tell us what kinds of things you hear from your colleagues about the pros and cons of IRB review for their studies?
I would say that most people on campus see the IRB process as very bureaucratic. And I have actually served on the UC San Diego IRB, and I'm frustrated by it sometimes. I think there are some incredibly dedicated people and incredibly skilled analysts, but they often, I feel like our process, and in fact we're even instructed in some ways to be bureaucratic. So we spend a lot of time talking about, did they comply with this checklist on their consent form? So I guess I'm answering by telling you how I feel about the IRB, and I think they're too bureaucratic. My colleagues, I would say the UC San Diego IRB, we get our work done, and my colleagues know that.
Okay, well, so given that, I mean, part of what you talked about, I think, is really interesting, because I know that IRBs, one of the ideas of saying it's an institutional review board and not a national review board is that you can adapt to the local culture. And you know what things are like and what's expected. So what that means is I think some IRBs do consider more than just what's the harm to the individual subject. And I've even heard that our IRB, for example, say, what will be the impact on this community if we do that study in that community? I'd like to expand this beyond UCSD. You're involved in the American Political Science Association. What's your sense? Do IRBs almost never look beyond the individuals when they talk about these studies? And if they don't, then maybe political scientists should come up with an alternative method for themselves for how we should review this.
So clearly there's no future for me in late night television because I don't have a good answer to that question. I'm a guy who knows what's going on in Brazil right now and why and how it's affecting democracy. There are people who know a great deal about how IRBs work in general. Within political science, that's a question. Should we think about that risk of an election? Should we think about that risk of affecting an election? And I think most political scientists would say we should not do anything that would change an election for some political organization, for some unit. But I don't actually know how other IRBs are.
Okay,
that's exactly
fair enough.
What they're saying.
I love that you're saying I don't know rather than answering anyway. So let's ask something you do know about. So why do you care about politics in Brazil? Are you trying to understand for Brazil? Are you trying to understand for the world? Why are you doing that?
This is going to be the worst interview ever.
I thought you were doing great.
So years ago, I was an undergrad at Berkeley and quite idealistic. And I wrote my senior thesis on Amazon rainforest policy. And I actually went to Brazil and I was a volunteer with, I was out in the rainforest, the northeastern Amazon with rubber tappers, and I was with NGOs in the deep south. And I found a country full of promise and wonderful people with so many problems. And I felt like I wanted to contribute to, in some small way, to helping them solve some of their political problems. So I guess that's why I became a political scientist working on
that. That sounds wonderful. I don't see what the problem with that is. So given that, I mean, obviously you're asking the question, at what point do you decide to do something, even if you can't get local approval or even if you can't get the population to know that they're part of a study? And how are you balancing that for yourself?
So I'll tell you openly about two of my experiences. I don't do many experiments, but I did a small lab experiment in Brazil in 2006. And it involved students going to a classroom and being paid a small amount of money to watch a video, and there was a positive ad, a negative ad, or a generic ad in there. And I just wanted to see how they responded to those. And they responded. There was a pretty strong response by low-income groups and low-education groups and not by higher education groups. I broke all sorts of rules because I was ignorant. I didn't intend to go there and do this, but it turns out it's against the rules to pay subjects in Brazil. So I was doing that wrong. It turns out they have an IRB, and as a young junior faculty member, I had no idea that they had an IRB. I had permission from the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Brasilia. I had IRB approval from UC San Diego. I thought I was doing everything right. And I went with the best of intentions, and I broke all sorts of rules. Nobody got hurt, but it was disrespectful to their institutions and their ethical process. And I had I didn't intend to do that. Today, and more recently, the Brazilian ethical review system has been set up to, like I said, to kind of prevent pharmaceuticals and crazy anthropologists to going and doing bad things because they've had some terrible experiences there. But it means that today, or until recently, doing a simple survey there would require national approval from the Ministry of Health. And that's what took so long. So that experiment that I did, I had approval from the Ethical Review Committee at the University of Sao Paulo. And I never got a response. I still to this day haven't gotten a response from the Ministry of Health's Ethics Committee from that 2006, or this was in about goodness, about 2009. And so we went ahead and did the study after talking to local political scientists, and they all said, you should do this, go ahead and do it. So we had local, we had approval from the University of Sao Paulo. I couldn't get them to even answer my phone calls at the national level, so we went ahead and did it. Today they've actually, there was a big push from Brazilian social scientists to clean this up. Today they've actually improved their procedures dramatically. So I think that going forward we'll all be able to be in full compliance with their rules. I believe that'll be the case.
Yeah, and the key here is that you want to do the right thing. Early on, you thought you were doing the right thing, even though you weren't. And I take it this has not resulted in any court dates for you in Brazil or anything else for having...
Well, hopefully your 100,000 viewers aren't Brazilian judges or something like that. But I was the first American political scientist, as far as I know, to even try that process. So I'm not going to be alone. I'll have good company. Lots of wonderful people, wonderful colleagues will be there with me. Anyway.
Okay, so part of the reason I went down that line of questioning is because if you do care about what you're going to get, then it at the very least, many of the kinds of studies you'd want to do really would require deception. And this is a well-trod path for IRBs. There are things that you might want to do that if you told the people what you're studying, then the experiment would be a failure right from the beginning. So I got the impression from what you said that you're very worried about deception because people might not want to be participating. And so having said that, very few people actually participated in our survey. I'll take credit. My survey, it's not your fault. We got three answers, ranging from 12.5 to 40% was kind of their threshold for how high they would go and still say if that many people are saying no. I'm not sure what I want to do with that. Part of me feels like the usual standard should be nobody should be in your study unless they are willing to be in your study. And that means if you do a study and everybody has to be in it, then everybody should have to say yes. But if you had that standard, you'd never get everybody to say yes.
So let me rewind and respond to your first comment about deception. And then let's think about this question of quote-unquote forcing people into studies. On the deception question, deception means all sorts of things. It can mean when a student comes into a lab and they know that they're going to watch a video and answer a survey, you don't tell them exactly what the study is about. That's this much deception. And there are scientists, there are economists in particular, would say zero deception ever. Everyone has to understand everything. And then there's deception where I'm going to deceive you and you don't even know you're in a study. And I would call that big deception. So personally, I'm okay with little deception where you're in a study and I don't tell you everything about the survey before I ask you the question. Or I don't tell you everything about the video you're about to watch. The big deception where we're forcing people into a study without their permission, that's a different one. I actually really want to hear from the audience on some of this. I'm personally very disturbed by even by 20%. That means one in five people don't want to be in one of our studies. That sounds really high to me. I was at a little conference at Stanford maybe 9 months ago, and they were extremely hostile to the positions I presented here. Extremely hostile. One of them said, people get deceived every day. People die every day. What's the big deal? And I mean, I was just blown away by this, and I was stunned. But it was someone who cares a great deal about their research questions, someone who is doing good research, but is really committed to this field experiments without informed consent because we're learning so much and no one's getting hurt, so we're just going to do it. So I don't know if 20% is too high or too low. I will tell you, my advice to political scientists has been, if you're going to do these kinds of things, number one, tread lightly. Don't out-campaign the other candidates. Do it, like be as small as you can, not as big as you can. They probably didn't need to send flyers to 100,000 Montanans. They probably could have done 1,000, right? So if you're going to do this, tread lightly, confess, tell them afterwards that you did it for two reasons. One, it shows them, three reasons. It shows them respect, shows you learn what they thought about it, and if you know you're going to have to face the music, you might be a little less likely to do something really crazy. And the third thing I said, which was also got me laughed at, that happens a lot, was I said compensate. I said pay them for their time, which you took without telling them, right? Send them $10. Why don't you figure out your hourly rate, whatever you're paid by your university, estimate their time to deal with whatever you sent them, and pay them. And maybe $10 should be the minimum. I'll bet people wouldn't mind being in these studies. People don't like these ideas so much. But I've taken a little bit of a strong position on some of these things. I'm very good friends with some of the people who have polar opposite positions. I want to hear what you think about these things. I would love to hear what you think about these things.
So let's do two things. One is we can certainly do a show of hands survey. So how many of you would be reluctant to do a really useful survey but it requires the deception that people don't know they're in a study? How many of you would be willing to do that if you found out that 20% of the people would not be willing, they didn't want that to happen? How many would be okay with that, with 20%? So I only see, actually a fair number of people are willing to go for a, how many people would still be okay with if 50% of the people said they don't want to be in it? Interesting. How many people would go, 100% of the people said, I don't want to be. that's not a scientific survey we just did, but it's interesting to see where those numbers went. Another thing is people are welcome to come to the microphone now or later if you've got thoughts on this question or others. Sure, so. And while you're on the way over there, so part of this idea of deception, that, as I said, it's used for lots of other kinds of studies. And the standards you talked about are pretty well accepted, that after the study, you can deceive somebody ahead of time, but after the study, part of your obligation is to go back to people and tell them, I was deceiving you. This is what we were studying, and this is what we found. It seems like a really low bar to have to achieve that. And if you're getting pushback on that, I think you've got some people who need to step back a bit here.
So just the crack through which we're driving semis is that in the common rule, the common rule isn't an ethics document. It's federal regulations that govern human subjects, experiments, and so on that involve federal dollars. That's what it is. So if you get federal money, the common rule applies to you if you're doing research. And it says in there you can skip consent if getting consent would mess up the study, and it's minimal harm. And there's one other condition. And then the fourth condition is, whenever practical or practically possible, you go back and tell people that you did this. I've never seen anybody actually. I've only seen that once, that people went back. It was actually one of those email studies where someone was emailing me pretending to be a grad student, and later they sent an email saying, remember that email? If you want to delete your data from the study, you can. And that was an experiment. So people aren't complying with that fourth piece of the puzzle. One of my colleagues who opposes constraints on this research, his line was, well, it would just be too hard to go back to the 65 million people that were in my last study. Something like that. He said, how could I debrief 65 million people?
How did he reach 65 million people in the first place?
I don't know. He must have a bigger budget than I do.
So when you're doing a lot of this talking, I'm thinking about what these, like, you're like how I'm acquiring the data and the consent form in that. But a lot of my, like, for numbers, should it be 1% or 20% or whatever, I have to think about who's going to actually use this data later. So you run an experiment. I don't know. I participated in it. Are the Russians going to get it? And then we're really screwed, kind of. Because I think what number I would put on the back of a survey would depend on also what are you asking and what could it potentially be used for. For me, that would matter. as opposed to a raw number?
So I think that's a great observation as well, and it's maybe challenging because Mike has worked a lot on this, but reproducible science is the new norm. When you publish something, you release your data so that people can reproduce your results and see if you really do get those numbers when you analyze the data. And there are standards for anonymizing data and so on and so on and so on. But in this era of big data, it's kind of difficult to imagine how you would anonymize everything in some studies. But do you have any thoughts about that one, Mike?
Well, it sounds like two things. I'm not sure I see yet the connection to her question, so I might be missing part of it. I mean, your question, I think, is, let me go to this part first. So, I mean, part of what you want to do, the anonymizing, is to protect people's privacy and so on. And I just don't think, for the most part, that's what people are worried about. They might say they don't want to be in the study because there could be lots of reasons. And one might just be, I want to know what I'm doing. It's not that I'm fearful I'm going to be harmed. It's that I want control over my life and my data. And I want to know, as I think you talked about, people want to know who's studying them. So I'm not sure how much of this is that they're fearful of being outed. Maybe that's what it is. So what I just realized is this has been so interesting. Our time is actually up. So I want to thank you very much for a really interesting conversation, and the audience as well.
Thank you all.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.